So my name is Graham Mooney. I'm here interviewing Kathy Doyle and Keith Mooney, my parents, for The Gathering. It's March 6th, 2011, and please state your names and stuff for the record.
This is Kathy Doyle.
I'm Keith Mooney.
So, you guys weren't born in Montana.
No, we weren't.
So I'm curious, kind of, like, where you're from and how you ended up here in Butte.
Okay, you want to start, Keith? You came the furthest.
Well, I was born in London, England. And I've lived lots of places. I guess I'm Irish that way because they're all over the world. Let's see. How did I get to Butte?
Well, first your parents emigrated from from
From
London.
London. My mother is from Ireland. My dad was from London. My mother moved to London when she was a young woman. And they emigrated to Detroit, where my mother's sister had gone. She was in the British Army during World War II, and she met an American and married him and went back to Detroit with him. And my mother followed her there.
On the Queen Mary.
On the Queen Mary, he came over, yeah. But we were in low class cattle
Steerage.
steerage, yeah. Okay. I moved to Helena with Kathy in 1981 because we wanted to be near Kathy's nephew Dylan, because his mother had died the previous year.
That's how we ended up in Montana.
That's how we ended up in Montana.
Yep. And the reason that Dylan was in Montana, well, I grew up in Detroit. That's where Keith and I met. My mom's sister was married to an air traffic controller, my Uncle Pat, Mary and Pat Kennedy. And so they lived in various places around the West, and they ended up in Helena. And he was an air traffic controller there, and they raised their kids there, lived there for a long time, and that's how my sister ended up in Helena, and
She
here we came.
came out here, out to Helena with her cousin, who was Pat and Mary's daughter.
Right, when she was 19.
Really?
Oh, she was younger.
18
18.
maybe? Yeah. So Colleen graduated from high school early and moved to Helena to live with Beth, a little party animal. And yeah, so they actually went back and forth a couple of times. Roger and Colleen lived in Indiana when Dylan was born, and then they came back to Montana, and that's where they were living when she died. So that's how we got here.
So, us aside, like Dylan and Kara and myself, like once we were adults, I guess, what kind of compelled you guys to come back to Montana eventually and stay here?
Well, I had been going to graduate school in California, and my funding ran out, and Mom couldn't stand California anymore. Kathy couldn't stand California anymore.
We were there for 6 years.
Yeah.
That was a long time.
And I was away a lot, quite a bit of that time, and in Ireland. And when I got back, I didn't have any more grant money. We were very deeply in debt, and we visited Roger, who is Dylan's dad, in Butte. And we saw how inexpensive houses and such were here. So we decided to come on back to Montana.
I really wanted to come back to Montana, and we knew people here in Butte. We had friends here. Some of our Helena friends had moved to Butte, and we had other people that we sort of knew that we thought we'd like to get to know better, and you were here. It's a compelling reason to return.
Wasn't I in Nebraska when you guys came back?
Maybe.
I think you were in Missoula at first.
Yeah. Anyway, you were more likely to be here than anywhere else. And like Dad said, you know, the cost of living in Butte was good. Job prospects weren't that great, but I don't know. And I like Butte because it reminded me of Detroit. It's kind of a combination of urban and in the middle of all that beautiful country that we like so well. But that's why they call it Butte America, I guess. Because people in Butte felt like they were kind of their own entity. They didn't relate to all of the farmers and ranchers in Montana. They were miners. They were industry. That's where we came from, industry.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. I guess that's one reason Butte felt comfortable to me.
So, when I was a kid and we were living in Helena, like, I don't really remember a whole lot of, I mean, St. Patrick's Day aside, like, a whole lot of Irish culture in my life. I mean, Grandma used to tell us terrifying stories when she lived in Helena, but...
Right.
So, I don't remember a whole lot of it from when I was a kid, and I'm curious when it kind of came more to the forefront of our family's consciousness, like what kind of brought about the interest in our culture and heritage and stuff.
Well, I was studying, I'm an anthropologist, and I was interested in migration, people moving around, and while we were in California at the time, a lot of Irish people were coming to work in the Silicon Valley because they had, if anybody knows recent Irish history, their education focused on technical education over the last 30 or 40 years. And a lot of those people brought that education to work in Silicon Valley. And around about that time, Ireland had a big information technology explosion, and people were going back. And I was interested in just the movement of people. And when I got to Ireland to study this, I know there were people all over the world, from all over the world, coming to work in Ireland, and that was the focus of my study, was how this movement of people came to a place where people had always emigrated from, not immigrated to, although people had immigrated to Ireland, but not in this mixture of people from Africa and the Philippines and
China.
So I wasn't so much interested in what people would consider traditional Irish culture.
Mm-hmm.
I was interested in the intersections of cultures and what kind of social groupings would develop in that situation.
Let's see.
And I don't know, I guess I would say that your mom was... there was no sentimentality for the homeland from Grandma.
I've noticed that.
You know,
so
my mother, her young life in Ireland was, to hear her tell it, was pretty hellish, even though she came from a fairly well-to-do family. Her well-to-do father died when she was young, and
and probably my family, who was, my parents were second generation American, Irish on both sides, they probably had more, have more sentimentality towards Irish culture, probably because they're further removed from it.
Yeah.
But, you know, the aunts you know, took a big trip to Ireland, and you know, they've always, you know, had their bleak and all that stuff. And my dad, you know, he was a big I don't know, what would you call him? He had a lot of enthusiasm for a lot of different things, including his Irish heritage. Let's put it that way. So, but, you know, I mean, we didn't learn to dance or, you know, any of those things. And part of that was because finances, I'm sure. If we'd had more disposable income, which, you know, there's not a lot to dispose of when there's seven kids, he probably would have liked to, you know, steer us into dancing and AOH activities. But, you know, it was...
Well, since my mother married an Englishman, even though my dad is of Irish heritage, he's a Mooney. And some of the things I've learned when I was doing my studies on Irish culture is when the Irish Catholics in London, in their schools, the teachers, the nuns, and the priests made an effort to make sure that those children considered themselves English. They didn't want to be at odds with the British national culture. And my dad never felt Irish, I don't think. He was very proud to be British. He was in the Navy during World War II, the British Navy. And my mother always kind of resented the fact that people in America couldn't see that Irish and English people interacted in loving ways.
Right.
There's more Irish and English people are married to each other than Irish and English people marry in anybody else. besides their own. And she tried to go to AOH in Detroit once, and she was ostracized because she had married an Englishman. And
well, and the other thing was, is at that time in the late 50s and 60s, her perception was that all they were doing was raising money for guns. Yeah. And there was a certain amount of truth to that. You know, the people who felt that they had been displaced in a previous generation, usually most of those people in the Detroit area at that time weren't recent immigrants. They were, you know, second or third generation, like my parents. And they were trying to fund the IRA. So they felt like that was something they could do for their homeland. And, you know, your mom, having just come from there, knew that wasn't a good idea.
Yeah.
So she, I think that's one reason, you know, besides, yeah, that's one reason that Irish culture was not big in your household, I think. But, 'cause she was consorting with the enemy. Seriously. I mean, people really had that viewpoint, I think.
Well, that's a common phenomenon when people are a generation or so removed from their homeland. Things that are minor in their homeland take on larger, much larger
significance.
Like St. Patrick's Day, I mean, it's a significant thing in Ireland, and now they have big parades and fireworks and everything, but when my mom was growing up, it was just a day you went to church.
Right.
It's a holy day.
But when it got moved to America, there's major celebrations in big cities. It's like an Irish national holiday here.
Right.
Yeah. And in Detroit, when we were growing up, I mean, that was very true. I mean, you know, they had a really big parade, and they always did it on the weekend so that there was lots and lots of people there. And then, you know, when we were in Helena, we did go to a parade in Helena once, and it was less than a block long. I mean, it was like, we celebrated St. Patrick's Day in our own way, you know, when you guys were kids, and it didn't have to do with drunken partying.
No.
Or
and there were no bagpipes.
Or green lays. So yeah, so when we came to Butte, you know, they do take St. Patrick's Day to a whole different level here.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, what's it like to kind of go from this environment where it's not such a big deal, where Irishness is just kind of whatever, you know, everybody's Irish on St. Patrick's Day. What's it like to kind of go from several environments where it's like that back into one that's kind of a where it is more of a big deal?
Well, it's kind of interesting. I mean, you know, we always had a certain amount of resentment towards the everyone's Irish on St. Patrick's
right,
Day.
Because that just meant everybody got drunk on St. Patrick's Day. Which
right. And I mean, when we were kids, we took it very seriously that we wore our green to school. And
yeah, I had to wear a shamrock.
And yeah.
My mother's friends would send over a real shamrock from Ireland, and nobody believed they were real shamrocks because they're these little tiny things.
Right.
They're almost like moss.
Right.
They're not these big clovers.
Right. And my dad would buy each of us girls a green carnation on St. Patrick's Day. But yeah, so to, you know, come into a place like Butte, which, I mean, there are a lot of Irish people here, and they take it pretty seriously. I mean, it's probably one of the only places where they actually have the parade on St. Patrick's Day, no matter what day of the week that is. And I like the parade. I like the, you know, they'll have the dancers. And, you know, there's a certain element here where they're actually honoring the culture, right? Which lasts until about noon. And then you want to have yourself some corned beef and cabbage, go back to the office, and, you know, and that's it, because then everybody's Irish for a day, and, you know, it's just not nice to be uptown. So, I don't know, it's like, in some ways, it's nice to have this, the event, rather than just, you know, your own little private family honoring. But on the other hand, you know, you don't want to take it to the extreme that they do here. So, I don't know. And Dad hates those damn bagpipes.
Well, I don't
and they're everywhere in Butte.
Well, what bothers me is, in Ireland, if somebody marches down the street playing bagpipes, that's a provocation. That's in marching season, they call it in the north, where the Protestant families go marching through the Catholic neighborhoods just to rile people up. I mean, they say they're not doing it just to rile people
right.
up, but they start riots. And,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, to see them marching down the street in their red and white plaid here, it just rubs me the wrong way.
Mm-hmm. Plus, you don't like the sound. Right. Plus, they play them indoors here.
Yeah.
Which, you know...
Outdoor instruments.
Yeah, they're
you know, the definition of a gentleman bagpipe player, one who doesn't do it in public.
when PJ Curtis came to talk, he said that the bagpipes were a joke that the Irish gave to the Scottish, and they still haven't figured it out.
That's pretty good. So yeah, St. Patrick's Day is almost upon us, and
yeah,
it'll be.
Well, it's interesting to see in other parts of the world how things get changed.
Right.
I mean, like Carnival is Mardi Gras and all that. I mean, it just things take on their own meanings and their own forms. Like I was saying, when my mom was young, people went to church on St. Patrick's Day, and that was pretty much it. And then when Americans started going back and wanting something, that became part of the tourist industry, which was a major industry in Ireland for a long time. Still is, but...
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, I mean, here the Irish were not in Butte. The Irish were the capitalists. They were the people who
mm-hmm.
ran the place, and the Slavs and such who came later worked for them. It wasn't, they weren't downtrodden here.
Well, there were plenty of Irish in the mines.
Yeah, there were Irish in the mines too.
But they were, yeah,
they,
the upper class.
The Harringtons and all.
Mm-hmm. Although the Downies,
yeah,
but they weren't particularly well-to-do. I mean, this house was a boarding house. And
not while they lived here.
Right, but, you know.
And I had to be fairly well-to-do to raise that many kids.
That's why the Irish are poor everywhere. Seriously, I mean, no, you didn't have to be well-to-do to raise that many kids. You just did it.
Yeah.
Did the best you could.
Well, he was an electrician for the mining company.
Yeah.
So I'm sure he made pretty good money.
Yeah.
But, let's see. So we spent some time we were submerged into pure Irish culture for a while. Remember when we went to Glen Comkeel, and people still speak Irish there.
Right.
And that's their industry there, is
language tourism.
Yeah.
Not just tourism, but they had a lot of the people who went to the school there were teachers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there were only a couple places where the teachers could maintain their certification to teach Gaelic.
Interesting.
Yeah, so they had a lot of teachers there. Not so, I mean, they catered a certain amount to tourists, but I don't think that was their focus.
No, it was
yeah.
it was a real college.
Right, right.
And,
so they had they offered different courses, especially during the summer, besides the language studies, but they were more of a kind of a side thing. You know, the bulk of the people who would be in town at any given time to attend the school were doing language studies.
Yeah, we lived there for a month.
Yeah, Kara just told me the other day that she took harp lessons. She took harp
lessons. She took one harp lesson.
Yeah.
It was in the basement. It was in an old church, an old stone church, and it was probably 50 degrees in there, and she was freezing.
I think it was supposed to be a week long, and you know she thought that sounded pretty cool to play the harp, so we signed her up and took her down there, and it was supposed to end at like 4 o'clock, and she didn't come home, and she didn't come home, and finally about 5:30 or so, Dad went down to the church to see what the heck was going on, and they were still down there in that cold, cold basement, and they weren't done with their lesson yet, and I think she was holding up okay till Dad said, I'm sorry, you have to go now, and then she just, like, started bawling. I mean, it was, like, one of the worst days of her life, I think.
Really?
I don't know. Maybe she didn't tell you that, but, but it was kind of traumatic.
Irish teachers are strict.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's like, okay, well, I think we're not going back there. This is supposed to be a good experience, and it definitely wasn't. So, but they had, you know, they did have some other courses, and Kara and I did a course that was like, in the morning they'd have a lecture, and then in the afternoon we'd do a field trip. And so, you know, we did some bird watching, and we learned where all the trees went, and we hiked out to the monuments, and that was pretty fun. But so that part was like, that was more geared towards the tourist
right.
kind of thing. And, you know, there were probably a handful of us doing that, but there were probably 30 of them doing
right.
language.
Yeah, yeah.
So
Michael, I guess, was he was doing it for his teaching certification. He lived in Northern Ireland, but he wanted to teach in the Republic, so he had to get certified in the Irish language. And his friend was there, who is he's from London, His mother was Irish and his father was Polish, but he had a very strong London accent, Dennis Walensky. And he is a big shot in the Northern Irish National Television Network. And he had lots of shows on Irish culture. And actually he brought a film crew in one day into our class to film it for the Northern Irish Television Network.
Was he the guy who came here not too long ago? And I think there was some kind of report on the Irish Irish Studies program. I think Michal was interviewed for it, the Fulbright scholar, a year or two ago.
I don't know. We were kind of friends for a while. When I was living in Ireland, I actually went and stayed with him for a day or two. But we had some disagreements on religious matters.
Yeah. What kind of disagreements? I mean,
he was very, very strong anti-abortionist, and I've always been of the opinion that men, when they can carry a baby, they can decide about abortion. But that's my personal thing. That's not Irish.
It's not Catholic either.
No. Yeah, I mean, okay. So what about the religion? I mean, I know you guys were raised Catholic and went to school. What kind of effects did the religion have on growing up and your life since you kind of fell away from the church? Or walked away from the church, as the case may be.
I don't know, it gives you a certain amount of moral sense, especially, I mean, the good parts, the Jesus' teachings, you know, I don't have any qualms with that. My main problems with the Catholic Church are the patriarchy.
Yeah.
And, I'll just leave it at that.
Well, I mean, were you guys part of large Catholic communities in Michigan, or?
Well, each parish had a sizable amount of Irish people.
Yeah.
St. Francis de Sales, in particular, had a, there were a lot of Irish and a lot of Italians.
Yeah, we had Italians and Irish.
And it was a huge parish when I started elementary school. But by the time I was in eighth grade, they were starting to close down. I think they closed the high school first, actually. But it was a 1-12 school, and yeah, well, it's, I don't know. It, in those days, Catholic schools provided a higher level of education than than you could get in the public schools in Detroit. And so when they closed the high school and I was ready for high school, I wanted to go to public school. Cooley High was my local public school. And my parents, absolutely not. So I had to go to Immaculata, which was a girls' school. At least St. Francis would have been co-ed, but you know, had to go to the girls' school and pay my own tuition, by the way, which I thought was particularly stinky. But the following year, when Colleen was ready for high school, her eighth grade teacher had an in with some nuns in Livonia at a different girls' school, and they were looking to, they weren't just looking for poor kids, they were trying to integrate.
Right.
So they, reached out to some of the city schools looking for students that they could give scholarships to. So Colleen's teacher picked her, even though she wasn't African American, and sent her out to Ladywood for an interview. And my mom said, "Well, you're going too. Maybe they'll take you too." So the two of us went out there and interviewed for scholarships, and they took us both for free tuition, which was good, but we spent a fortune driving back and forth, I think. And in the meantime, they closed the elementary portion of St. Francis Parish, so my younger siblings were looking for a new school too, and they took them at a school that was partway between where the high school was and where we lived. So they went to St. Valentine's after that. But, you know, it was still, it was both an educational and a safety issue, I think, by that point.
Right.
Because of where we lived.
Yeah.
But the nuns didn't beat us like the priests did at Catholic Central, so.
Yeah, there was lots of physical violence at Detroit Catholic Central, and it was just expected. I mean, if a student raised their hand in defense, they were out of there.
Really?
Yeah, and the priest would slug you. They'd hit you with hockey sticks.
Rubber hoses? Didn't some guy have a...
Yeah, Mr. DeRocher.
A rubber hose?
Yeah. They'd wrap your hands with rubber hoses. They'd get in your face.
In elementary, there was a certain amount of that sort of thing, but it was always directed at the boys, of course, not at the girls. But once I got to high school, I was on easy street compared to... There were advantages to
Well, they hear all the clamor about sexual abuse and the clergy and such. Nobody ever talks about the physical abuse.
Right.
And I think that's another reason, one of the things that turned me away.
From the church.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I don't know, I think there were... I mean, there were... The church was doing some good things, you know, a lot of... Church members, like when I was in that, you know, middle to high school age, were actively protesting the war, the Vietnam War. They were working really hard on poverty issues, which was a big deal in our neighborhood in Detroit. Homelessness didn't seem to be so prevalent back then, but, you know, but there was a lot of poverty, you know, kids not eating, and so the church was really involved in that stuff, which was good, and I guess that probably affected how our worldview, and you know that the rich people aren't entitled to have all this stuff. But the like Dad said, that you know, the patriarchy and the things that the church would... Like the church said, you can't use birth control.
Right.
And, you know, we have all these families in our parish that just keep having more and more kids. And, how do you support them? Well, you're not doing it very well. So to tell people that they couldn't use any sort of contraceptive was just ridiculous. So then people would pick and choose.
Right.
Well, yeah, okay, I'm a Catholic, but I don't believe this part. It was, you know, cafeteria style or whatever. And I didn't go along with that. I don't think that you can, just didn't seem right. It's like, you know, there's other faith communities out there that probably match more closely what you think. So why are you stuck with the one that you grew up with? Probably just because you don't know any better. And, you know, really, Catholics... didn't really want us to know about any other religions.
Really?
That wasn't something that you would...
Yeah, you weren't supposed to go into another church.
Mm-mm.
Although when I took comparative religion at Detroit Catholic Central, I did. We went to a synagogue. We went to a mosque. So, but it was more like an anthropological endeavor rather than any kind of...
Right.
Appreciation.
Well, the comparative religion course that I took, I laughed because the nun had this, she wore this same blouse almost every day that had this enormous, ruffle, and it would always flip up into her face, and so she was pushing it down. She's always pushing her ruffle down, but mostly we focused on Asian traditions, you know, and there were nobody practicing Buddhism in the Detroit metropolitan area that we knew about, you know, so even with that class, I never got a field trip. Damn. I've still never been in a synagogue.
Really?
No. Or, you know, very few other churches, unless it's for a funeral or something. But,
yeah.
So, anyway. So that's where we were with Catholicism, running as fast as we could after 12 years of Catholic education.
Yeah.
At least I was.
Yeah.
Although, you know, some of my siblings, Mary in particular, she, something about going to church really upsets her.
Really?
Yeah, and like for me, it's like I don't mind, you know, if Grandma asked me to take her to Mass, I probably would, you know, if I had to. and, you know, I can go to a funeral or go to a wedding, you know, and it doesn't bother me. But Mary finds it really distressing for some reason, so I'm not sure what that, like, a really emotional response.
I feel that. It bothers me, too.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's why we go to funerals, but that's about it.
Yeah.
I don't know if there's anything more depressing than an Irish Catholic funeral.
Well, we've been to a Lutheran funeral that was way more depressing than anything I've seen in Catholic. But I don't want to go there.
Yeah, so when you guys were small, mm-hmm. We didn't want to take you to Catholic church, but I kept feeling like there should be some kind of church so you'd have something to push against. Seriously, because my friend Jane, one of her sons converted to Mormonism, which I feel is extreme and sort of terrifying. And so I thought, well, if you had just some, you know, basic Christianity to rebel against, you know, and give up, then, you know, I wouldn't have to worry about you embracing something kooky.
Interesting.
So my friend Janine and I several times tried to sort of, you know, figure out where we could take you kids that would be, you know, inoffensive, basically.
Yeah.
And we never did pull it off, so.
I think Grandma took you to Mass once.
Yeah, I wasn't a big fan. Kara went with the pancakes.
Yeah.
As I recall.
I think, I thought you might be impressed with the pageantry, but.
Now I am. Yeah. I've got a lot more interest in the in the pageantry and the weird little rituals that kind of go along with the Catholic thing. Like, I consider myself culturally Catholic, even though, you know, obviously I wasn't raised with it, and
right.
What I know is kind of second or third hand, but
yeah, well, there are just too many things that we didn't believe in to want you to get wrapped up in that. So,
and the church became more. When we were young, the church was, like your mom was saying, was
progressive.
It was progressive. It was Christian. They were trying to do what Jesus would have wanted.
Right.
But then, as the Cold War developed, the church became more an instrument of anti-communism.
Really?
Yeah. And that, especially with John Paul II, because he was from Poland.
Right.
And their whole political, the priests. There used to be something called liberation theology. I don't know if there might still be. There were priests who were down in Central and South America trying to help people, but at the same time understanding that politically they needed to get rid of the despots who were running the place, and they were actively involved in it, and a lot of them were getting martyred.
Oh.
But John Paul pretty much came out and said, "You guys keep your nose out of that stuff."
Yeah. Huh. It's become more, less about loving each other. You know what I mean? And making sure that people are treated right, and more about control.
Well, that's interesting, because, you know, in modern Catholic education, like, I've never heard of anything approaching some of the things you guys have talked about. Right. You know, so, yeah.
That's, well, but really interesting. But modern or contemporary, I should say, Catholic education is not anywhere near the level. There used to be as many, in Detroit, there were as many kids going to Catholic schools almost as public schools.
Oh, yeah. Huh. And half the kids in the public schools were going to catechism. For, you know, if their parents couldn't afford tuition, which was, they made a lot of effort to make sure that, you know, people could afford to go to Catholic school if they wanted to. But, you know, for whatever reasons, there were plenty of kids going to public school who were,
you know, both going my to catechism. Both my brothers started at Catholic school, and they both ended up in public schools, even in grade school.
Hmm. Were you living in Royal Oak by then? Or?
No, we were living in Detroit. I was going, we were in Precious Blood when
both. When they closed?
No.
Oh.
They.
Oh, the school didn't close. The school they just went to public school.
Right. They didn't. They didn't handle the discipline well.
Us older children were compliant, I guess.
So, yeah, they both went to public schools. I remember I was like in probably fifth or sixth grade, and teachers would come and get me to go talk to my younger brother because
he was misbehaving.
Something wasn't working out. Yeah.
Cool. So, yeah, anyway, the Catholic Church at that time was more socially, it was more like what the Unitarian Universalists are doing now.
Really?
Yeah.
You know, except for Universalists, Unitarians wouldn't be beating up their kids.
Well, no, but I mean, in terms of the social agenda, you know. But and I mean, they made us really aware when we were in school of, what was that book that guy wrote about poverty back?
The Other America.
From
Butte.
Yeah, I mean, we read that in seventh or eighth grade.
Huh.
You know, so yeah, that was, you know, a big part of that Catholic education. And, you know, I feel pretty good about the education I got. I mean, it's taken me a long way. At least, well, what my dad always said was, at Catholic school, they teach you how to think. How to solve your problem, how to figure a problem out, how to look at an issue. So, and I think, yeah, despite the beatings, they did a good job of that. So, but yeah, if there'd been a Unitarian Universalist church in Helena and I'd found it, that's probably what, you know, I mean, I didn't know anything about them until I started working there. And it's like, oh, wow. Yeah, these people have some pretty good ideals. And yeah, and you don't have to.
Yeah, there's even believe in atheist heaven or hell. Unitarians.
Right. Yeah, so I liked that. But anyway, you all were off the hook for Sunday morning activities as children. And fortunately, neither one of you turned out too weird. lack of churching. What else you want to talk about?
I don't know. I'm a little curious about with kind of the way you describe, like, church involvement and like Detroit being making a big deal out of St. Patrick's Day. I wonder, were there other non-St. Patrick's Day kind of like a little bit more cultural like observances in the church or outside the church that you guys participated in?
You mean in terms of Irishness?
In terms of Irishness or Irish Catholicism or whatever. I mean, you know, like a few weeks ago in Anaconda they celebrated St. Bridget's Day.
Every day was a Some Saints Day.
It was. Yeah, you get the little cross for St. Bridget's, right? You make a little cross out of palm fronds or something.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. But I would say not really. I mean, we didn't, you know, participate in extracurricular activities. So if there were some at the church, I didn't know about them. And
I mean, I might, for a while I thought I might have wanted to be a brother, you know, not a priest, but a
religious order.
And I used to go to a monastery and hang out on the weekends.
But yeah, I mean, you know, there was no Irish Mass that I know of. Or my dad used to go to a place to where he'd hear the Mass in Latin.
Yeah, I was gonna say, like, didn't the switch to vernacular Mass kind of happen while you guys were kids?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was Pope John. He was
radical.
He had what they call a Vatican Council, and that's where he was said, we're gonna reach out to other religions. We're going to make our religion more
accessible.
Yeah, you know, and more related to the real world. Mm-hmm. To the material world.
Mm-hmm. Which is probably where all that social activism came from. But yeah, we were, I don't know, I think I was already in elementary school when that happened. But because I remember, you know, your hymnal, your, not your hymnal, is that what you called it? You know,
Your missal.
Your missal, yeah. Lingo's gone. the missal was... Somewhere. Yeah, they were in Latin, you know. I mean, mm-hmm. When you were old enough to read, you were reading Latin.
But the sermon was always in English.
Right. Huh. Right. But yeah, somewhere in there.
And part of the Mass was in Greek.
Yeah.
Huh. Well, yeah. I mean, do you guys know about, like, if Grandma had Irish Mass? Or no. She was way before vernacular, I guess.
Yeah. It was always Latin.
Yeah, always Latin.
She hated Irish language because the nuns used to beat her up about it.
She's still got a pretty good grasp on it these days.
Yeah, well, I mean, she learned it, and
right.
It was there. It's all, I mean, in Ireland, everybody has to take the language in school,
right.
And hardly anybody speaks it.
Mm-hmm.
And but all the place names are Irish words. You know?
Yeah.
Street, I mean, signs.
And they even changed the ones that used to be English. They changed, like, Dunleary used to be Kingstown.
Right.
And what's Queenstown?
I used to know.
Yeah. Killarney or somewhere. I'm not sure.
Well,
I forgot what your original question was, Graham.
I did too.
What kind of extracurricular?
Oh, right.
Well, I mean,
were there other Irish cultural things outside of St. Patrick's Day?
Well, in Ireland, they when I was there, they had something called Reek Sunday.
Yeah.
It's the last Sunday in July, and you make a pilgrimage. And if you're really devout, you fast. And what it is, you go to a mountain on the west coast of Ireland called Crowpatrick. And there's thousands of people go, and they walk up the mountain, and the really devout ones fast, and they do it barefoot, and like after the first couple hundred feet, it's all just scree, just broken rock, and people are going up there without any shoes on, and their feet are bleeding, and they're swearing. And they're...
'Cause they're so devout.
And they're... there's lots of expressions of asceticism and people remarking on, oh, I'm never going to complain about sitting at my boring job again.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, that was confusing to me.
Yeah, I guess most of the stuff that comes to mind was more related to the church than
right.
to our Irish
right.
heritage.
When we get to the top of Crowpatrick, which is like a mountain that rises like 2,000 feet out of the sea, and
yeah.
And you get to the
Scrabble
top.
Scrabble up there with all the masses.
And then there's a church on top, a chapel.
Oh yeah.
And
concessions, right?
and people have concessions, and then there's a
well, bishop. You just fasted and climbed a mountain. Of course, you need to eat.
The bishop, the bishop says mass in this glass. He faces the outside. He's at a glass pulpit, like in this church, in this chapel, and he gets up there by a car coming up the other side of the mountain.
Because we're going, how do you get all that stuff up there? Oh, the other side has a road.
Did you guys make the pilgrimage? Did you climb?
Dad did, yeah.
It hurt. I mean, because it's all scree. It's
even with shoes.
Right, but see, you fall a lot because it's just slippery rock all the way.
Yeah.
And I didn't know, you're supposed to, if you have a walking stick, you're in a lot better shape. Because you got an extra,
So keep your balance.
They were selling them at the
top.
No, at the bottom. At the bottom, people just had sticks, and they were selling them to people. And
you know, what the hell do I need a stick for? Well, when we were up in Glencombe Keel, they had used to be a pilgrimage to St. Columba up there, and one day on our little afternoon journey. At the class we were taking, we did most of the like circuit, and it was actually more like stations.
Of the cross.
Yeah, right. Yeah, and it wasn't very strenuous like that, except I think you were supposed to do it multiple times, and like Dad said, you know they did it barefoot, which of course we had on our hiking boots, but but there was one particular place where we climbed up to. The station, and you were kind of just like right on the side of the mountain,
right?
And I don't like heights very much, so that freaked me out. It's like I wanted to crawl back down the trail after that, but yeah, people, we didn't have that sort of thing at home, but we did do a lot of rosaries. Those were pretty painful your knees.
Yeah, the stations of the cross too, but that wasn't painful at all.
No.
So with Grandma not being terribly fond of like traditional culture or the language, like did you guys ever have like an awareness of or an interest in the language when you were growing up or even?
Not particularly. I mean, like I knew Pope Mahone.
Well, what about when you guys were in Glencombe Keel? Like did you take classes or?
Yeah, I took.
Well, the reason we went there was because Dad needed
my language certification.
Yeah, he needed where do you take Irish, you know?
Right.
So it was an immersion thing.
So for the PhD, you could do one of two things. You could take your master's language to another level. Oh. My master's language was Spanish since I had changed my focus from California to Ireland. I thought it made more sense. Your other option was to take a second language. Mm-hmm. So I
gotcha.
I went to the Irish college there and got a certificate, and they accepted that as my language requirement.
Dad was always good with languages, and
yeah, I remember you were doing the linguistics thing when you first went back to school. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I'm terrible at languages, and I mean Irish. Well,
Kara
particular
and I both feel
terrifying.
That way, and Terry thinks we're.
You're good.
Pretty good at it, I guess. I'm pretty rusty these days.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But I mean, just the, yeah, it's just, I guess, you know, growing up with Latin, that didn't, then Spanish isn't quite as intimidating, even though I'm not, I never really got the hang of that. But you can kind of figure some stuff out just because of the
Latin. Yeah, they didn't teach Irish in Catholic schools.
No, they didn't. And so it's just so
German, French, and
the Catholic Church Latin. Was anti-Irish for quite a while in the 19th century because it was encouraging the weird Irish version of Catholicism to persist when they wanted it to be brought under the toe of Rome.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, yeah, well, actually, when I got to Ladywood in the 10th grade, they didn't even have Latin anymore.
Really?
They had Spanish and French. And so I don't know. I guess 1 year of I signed up for Spanish and I didn't get it. So I, 1 year of Latin was apparently enough to graduate. Hmm. But my friend Marcia had one of the old nuns. Mm-hmm. The campus of that high school was on the grounds where the mother house, where all the old nuns went to retire. Mm-hmm. And one of those old nuns tutored Marcia in Latin 1 or 2 days a week. And yeah, but that was kind of sad, actually. But I guess once they weren't using it in the mass anymore, they didn't think we needed it.
Yeah.
But yeah, no Irish in the schools. And
there are plenty of Irish teachers.
Yeah. But you know, that's something that didn't really make it through the trip to America for most
right
immigrants, I don't think.
At least the more recent ones.
Well, they were for people in Ireland were forbidden to speak Irish when the British.
Right. So maybe that's what it is, because most of, like, you know, the people who came over at the turn of the century, is when my.
I've heard that they used to have somebody give mass in Butte in Irish.
They do it every year for Henri Ra.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. It's one of the.
It's like the closing.
It's like the closing ceremonies. They do it in the park at Emma Park.
Uh-huh.
They do the Irish mass. But I don't know who does it, if it's somebody who always lives here, or if someone comes, if it's a visitor that does it, or I'm not sure.
I know when we were in Glen Comkeel, the man who ran the school, his name was Liam O'Quinningham, and he was a Catholic, Irish Catholic, but he resented the fact that they wouldn't say the Mass in Irish in Glen Comkeel when he was young.
Hmm.
And his mother spoke Irish, that was her native language. But the Episcopalian, or the Church of England, or as they call it, the Church of Ireland, they would.
They said, did their service in Irish?
Interesting. Yeah,
because it was the vernacular.
And why wouldn't the Catholics? Oh, they just did it in Latin.
Yeah.
Because everybody did Latin back then.
Yeah, but yeah. I mean, yeah.
Yeah, it was before vernacular was acceptable.
But after vernacular, they still wouldn't do
they
it.
They still wouldn't. Huh?
Yeah, he said he resented it because his mother.
So did they do it in English then, or in still in Latin?
I'm not sure. I think it was in English.
Interesting. But yeah, I guess there was not really any interest in the language, because people who came at that time weren't speaking it. But yeah, it's hard. I think it's hard.
Yeah, there's way too many letters.
We really gotta have all five of those vowels to make that particular sound.
And a couple G's and H's too.
Right.
How would you know when to take a breath? So given kind of all this stuff, like, I guess my next question is about Butte. Like,
right, that's what I was thinking.
There are a lot of people still moving here who are of Irish descent, like you guys, and there are a lot of people still living here long after the industry and, like,
mm-hmm.
things that their family did and celebrated are gone. And, I mean, do you think it's just, I mean, what do you think the reason that so many Irish descended people continue to come here and continue to stay here is, even though kind of everything that.
Well, I think part of it is the, advocacy of a small group of people, don't you, Keith?
Yeah.
I mean, really, I mean, like Monica, our neighbor.
Right.
She is very enthusiastic. And
it's true.
Right? And I mean,
she got the president of Ireland to come here.
Right. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the group that she works with, I know she doesn't operate alone, but, you know, the group that she works with, they make a lot of connections with people in Ireland.